with the order never to reappear at his aunt's. He then returned to the castle with rage in his heart. He contained himself, nevertheless. He came to find me, cajoled me as was his wont, asked me if the deed would take place the following day, pointing out to me that it was essential that it occurred before the Duke's arrival, then calmly went to bed without giving anything away. I was completely fooled by him, and so had no cause for alarm at that moment. If this terrible crime was carried out, as the Comte later informed me, he must have committed it himself, though I have no idea how. I conjectured many things, but it would serve no purpose to relate these to you. Let us come rather to the cruel manner in which I was punished for not having wanted to assume responsibility for it. The day after the messenger's arrest, Madame took her chocolate as usual and rose to wash and dress. She seemed agitated and seated herself at table. I had scarcely left the room when the Comte approached me.
"Thérèse," he said to me with the greatest sang-froid, "I have found a safer means than the one I had proposed to you to carry out our plans, but I need to explain the details to you and dare not come into your bedchamber so often. Be at the corner of the grounds at 5 o'clock precisely. I shall meet you there, and we shall take a walk in the woods, where I shall explain everything to you."
I confess to you, madame, that whether because Providence allowed it, or through excess of trust or sheer blindness, nothing prepared me for the shocking misfortune that awaited me. I felt so certain that the Marquise's secret and her plans were safe that I never imagined that the Comte could have discovered them. And yet I was nervous. According to one of our tragic authors, perjury is a virtue when there is a threat of crime. But perjury is always odious to the delicate and sensitive soul who feels obliged to have recourse to it. I felt unhappy with my role. In spite of this, I presented myself at the meeting place, and the Comte did not keep me waiting long. He approached me in a gay and carefree manner, and we went into the forest without there being any indication of anything but the laughter and jesting which he was used to share with me. When I wished to turn the conversation to the subject that had prompted him to ask for our meeting, he kept telling me to wait, that he feared we might be observed, and that we were not yet in a safe place. Imperceptibly, we reached the 4 trees to which I had been so cruelly attached. I started upon seeing this spot, and the full horror of my fate then presented itself to me. Imagine how my fears grew when I saw how this dreadful place had been prepared. Ropes hung from one of the trees. 3 monstrous hounds were tied to the other 3 and appeared just to be waiting for me to satisfy the hunger evident from their wide open and salivating jaws. They were under the control of one of the Comte's favourites. Then the perfidious creature turned to me, addressing me henceforth only in the coarsest of terms.
"Effing bitch," he said to me, "do you recognise this bush from which I dragged you like a wild animal to give you back the life which you deserved to lose? Do you recognise these trees from which I threatened to hang you again if you ever gave me occasion to repent my kindness to you? Why did you accept the mission I asked you to undertake against my aunt if you intended to betray me, and in what way did you imagine you would be serving virtue by risking the freedom of the one to whom you owed your happiness? Of these 2 crimes, why did you choose the most abominable one?"
"Alas, did I not choose the least abominable one?"
"You should have refused," continued the Comte furiously, seizing me by the arm and shaking me violently. "Yes, you should have definitely refused and not agreed to betray me."
Then Monsieur de Bressac told me everything he had done to intercept Madame's messages, and how the suspicion had taken root in him, prompting him to divert them.
"What has your falseness led you to do, unworthy creature?" he continued. "You have risked your life without saving my aunt. The deed is done, and I shall reap its rewards on returning to the castle. But you must die, and you must learn before you expire that the path of virtue is not always the safest one, and that there are circumstances in this world when complicity with a crime is preferable to treachery."
And without giving me time to reply, Without showing the slightest pity for the cruel state I was in, he dragged me towards the tree prepared for me and where his crony was waiting.
"Here she is," he told him, "the woman who intended to poison my aunt and who has perhaps already committed this frightful crime in spite of my attempts to prevent it. I should probably have done better to place her in the hands of justice, but she would then have lost her life, and I want to let her live so that she may suffer longer."
The two villains then grabbed hold of me, and in an instant had me stripped bare.
"What a lovely bottom,"
said the Comte in tones of the cruelest irony, and brutally touching it.
"What superb flesh! An excellent lunch for my hounds."
Once I no longer had a stitch on me, I was attached to the tree by a rope tied around my back, leaving my arms free to defend myself as best I could, and thanks to the slack left on the rope I was able to move forward or back about 6 feet. Once I was in this position, the Comte, who was very worked up, came close to look at my expression, and then encircled me. From the harsh manner in which he touched me, it seemed to me that his murderous hands intended to compete in rage with his dog's razor-like teeth.
"Come," he said to his assistant, "release these animals, it is time."
They are unchained, the Comte excites them, all three of them hurl themselves at my poor body. It is as if they are sharing it so that none of its parts is exempt from their furious assaults. I try to throw them off in vain. They just tear me apart with greater fury, and during this horrible scene, Bressac, the unworthy Bressac, as if my torments had ignited his perfidious lusts, the infamous Bressac indulged himself in criminal caresses with his crony.
"That's enough," he said after a few moments. "Tie the dogs up and let us leave this wretch to her sad fate."
"Well, Thérèse," he said to me in a low voice as he released my bonds,
"as you can see, virtue often costs you dear. Don't you think that a pension of 2,000 écus would have been preferable to the bites that now cover you?"
But in the awful condition I was in, I could hardly hear him. I threw myself at the foot of the tree and nearly lost consciousness.
"I've been good enough to save your life,"
said the villain, inflamed by my suffering.
"Take care, at least, how you use this favour."
He then ordered me to get up, gather my clothes, and leave that place as fast as I could. As blood was flowing from all over my body, I picked some grass to freshen myself and clean myself so that my clothes, the only ones I had left, would not be stained, while Bressac walked up and down, far more preoccupied with his own thoughts than with me. The swelling of my flesh, the blood that still streamed out of me, the dreadful pain I endured, all of this made the business of getting dressed almost impossible, and yet the dishonest man who had just put me in this cruel state, he for whom I would previously have laid down my life, never deigned to show me the least sign of sympathy. As soon as I was ready, he said,
"Go where you wish. You must have some money left, and I won't take it from you. But watch that you don't reappear in any of my town or country houses. There are two powerful reasons for this prohibition. It's best that you know first and foremost that the business you thought was concluded is not finished. You were told that it was, but you were misled. The charge against you has not been dropped. You were left in this situation so that we could see how you would behave. Secondly, you will be regarded in public as the Marquise's murderer. If she is still breathing, I shall ensure that she carries this thought with her to the grave. The entire household will know it. So there will be two charges against you instead of one. And in place of a vile usurer's adversary, a rich and powerful man will be determined to drive you into hell if you abuse the life that his pity grants you."
"Oh, monsieur," I replied, "however severely you have treated me, you may have nothing to fear from my behaviour. I thought I ought to take steps against you to save your aunt's life, but I shall not do so just for the sake of the unfortunate Thérèse. Farewell, monsieur. May your crimes make you as happy as your cruelty causes me to suffer, and whatever fate heaven has in store for me, as long as it preserves my lamentable life, I shall devote it entirely to praying for you." The Comte looked up. He could not help scrutinizing me at these words, and as he saw me about to collapse and streaming with tears, the cruel man walked away, no doubt afraid of showing emotion, and I never saw him again. Left abandoned to my pain, I slumped at the foot of the tree, and there gave it full voice, so that the forest echoed with my laments. I pressed my miserable body against the earth, and showered the grass with my tears.
"Oh, my lord," I cried. "It was your eternal decree that the innocent should become the prey of the guilty. Do what you will with me, lord. I am still a long way from the torments you suffered for us. May those that I am enduring in adoration of you make me one day worthy of the rewards you promise to the weak when they offer up their tribulations to you and glorify you in the midst of their pains."
Night was falling, and it was becoming impossible for me to go any further. I could scarcely stand up. I glanced at the bush in which I had slept 4 years earlier, in circumstances that were almost as miserable. I dragged myself over to it as best I could, and lying in the same place, tormented by my still bleeding wounds, overwhelmed by my troubled thoughts and my broken heart, I spent the cruelest night it is possible to imagine. The vigour of my age and of my temperament, having given me a little strength at daybreak, and too afraid to stay close to that cruel castle, I hurried to distance myself from it. I left the forest and, resolved to reach the first habitation that I came across, entered the small market town of Saint-Marcel, which was about 5 leagues from Paris, and asked for the house of the surgeon, which was pointed out to me. I begged him to dress my wounds, telling him that, having fled from my mother's house in Paris because of an affair of the heart, I had been ambushed by robbers at night in the forest, who, in revenge for my resistance to their lusts, had set their dogs on me. Rodin, as this surgeon was called, examined me very carefully, but found nothing dangerous in my wounds. He would, he said, have guaranteed to restore me in less than a fortnight to the health I enjoyed before my adventure, if I had arrived at his house immediately afterwards. But the night and my worried state had poisoned my wounds, and it would take a month for me to get better. Rodin put me up in his house, took care of me as best he could, and a month later, my body bore no more traces of Monsieur de Bressac's cruelty. As soon as my physical condition permitted me to take the air, my first concern was to try to find in the town a young girl adroit and intelligent enough to go to the Marquise's castle to find out everything that had happened since my departure. It was not really curiosity that drove me to do this, curiosity alone being obviously dangerous, and certainly quite out of place. But I had left the money I had earned at the Marquise's in my room. I had scarcely 6 louis on me, and had then more than 40 at the castle. I could not imagine that the Comte would be so cruel as to refuse what so rightly belonged to me. Persuaded that once he had recovered from his initial anger, he would not wish to be so unjust towards me, I wrote as touching a letter as I could. I carefully concealed from him the place where I was living, and begged him to send my old clothes on to me with the little money that belonged to me in my room. A 25-year-old peasant woman, quick-witted and humorous, undertook to deliver my letter, and promised that she would discreetly obtain enough information to satisfy me on her return with regard to all the matters which I explained needed clarification. I enjoined her, above all, to hide the name of the place where I was, not to speak of me in any way at all, and to say that she had been given the letter by a man who had brought it more than 15 leagues from there. Jeanette left, and 24 hours later she brought me back the response. I still have it. Here it is, madame. But before reading it, please listen to what happened at the Comte's after I had left. The Marquise de Bressac, having fallen dangerously ill the very same day that I left the castle, had died 2 days later in excruciating pains and convulsions. Her relatives came quickly, and her nephew, who appeared to be completely devastated, claimed that his aunt had been poisoned by a chambermaid who had fled the same day. They had started to search for her, intending to put the wretched woman to death if she were found. Moreover, as a result of his inheritance, the Comte was now considerably wealthier than he had thought. The Marquise's strongbox, wallet, and jewels, none of which were known to exist, gave her nephew, in addition to an annual income, More than 600,000 francs in effects and cash. People said that this young man could scarcely hide his joy behind his mask of affected grief, and having deplored the fate of the unfortunate marquise and sworn to avenge her if they laid hands on the guilty party, the relative summoned to attend the autopsy demanded by the comte had left the young man in full and quiet possession of his wickedness. Monsieur de Brissac had himself spoken to Jeannette, asking her various questions, to which the young woman had replied with such frankness and firmness that he had resolved to give her his response without pressing her further.
"Here is that fateful letter," said Thérèse, handing it to Madame de Lossange. "Yes, here it is, madame. It is sometimes close to my heart, and I shall keep it until I die. Read it, if you can, without trembling." Having taken the note from the hands of our beautiful adventuress, Madame de Lossange read the following. "A wicked girl, capable of poisoning my aunt, has the cheek to dare write to me after this loathsome crime. The best thing she can do is to keep herself well hidden. She can be sure that she will be in trouble if she is discovered. What does she dare ask for? Does she speak of money? Anything she may have left behind makes up for the thefts she committed, either during her time in the house or when she carried out her last crime. She should avoid sending another letter like this one, because I tell her that we would have the messenger taken into custody until the criminal's hiding place became known to the justice system." "Please continue, my dear child," said Madame de Lossange, handing the note back to Thérèse. "All of these events are quite horrific. To be swimming in gold and refuse to give an unfortunate girl what she legitimately earned when she had no intention to commit any crime is a gratuitous infamy that is without parallel."
"Alas, madame, I wept for 2 days over this unfortunate letter. I was hurt more by the horrible allegations it contained than by its refusal of my request.
So I am guilty," I cried. "Now I am denounced to the law a second time for having obeyed its laws too scrupulously. So be it. I am not repentant. Whatever may happen to me, at least I shall know no remorse as long as my soul is pure, and the only thing I have done wrong is to have listened too much to those sentiments of equity and virtue which will never abandon me."
Yet, it was impossible for me to believe that I was being sought by justice, as the comte claimed. This was so implausible, since it would be dangerous for him to have me brought in front of a court, and I imagined that at bottom he must be far more nervous about seeing me than I had reason to tremble at his threats. These reflections made me determined to remain where I was, and even to find a position, if that were possible, until I had increased my funds enough to be able to leave. But before I tell you what I decided to do, it is necessary to give you some idea of this man and his surroundings. Rodin was a man of 40 years, with brown hair and a heavy brow, a keen eye, and a strong, healthy demeanour, and yet at the same time a libertine air. With a background well above his rank, possessing an income of between 10,000 and 12,000 livres, Rodin practised the art of surgery purely out of interest. He had a very fine house in Saint-Marcel, which he shared only with 2 serving girls and his daughter, having lost his wife some years earlier. His daughter, a young woman by the name of Rosalie, who had just reached her 14th year, combined all of those charms capable of creating a sensation, a fresh, round face with extraordinarily animated expression, sweet and piquant features, the prettiest mouth possible, big brown eyes full of soul and feeling, chestnut hair falling down to her waist, a lovely complexion of remarkable delicacy, a bosom that was already the most beautiful to be found, and at the same time a witty, vivacious personality, and one of the dearest souls that ever nature had created. As regards the companions with whom I was to serve in this household, these were 2 peasant girls, one of whom was a governess and the other a cook. The one exercising the former function was probably around 25 years old, the other was between 18 and 20, and both were extremely pretty. The choice of these young women made me suspicious about Rodin's keenness to keep me in his house. "Why does he need a third woman?" I said to myself. "And why does he want pretty ones?" I thought, "There is definitely something in all this that does not conform to those accepted morals from which I do not wish to stray. I must be on my guard. I consequently asked Monsieur Rodin to allow me to spend another week recovering at his place, with the assurance that by the end of that time he would have my response to what he was offering me. I took advantage of this interval to form a closer bond with Rosalie, determined to accept a position in her father's house only if there was nothing in it that might make me take offence. With this in mind, I kept a careful watch over everything, and the very next day, noticed that this man had an arrangement that from that moment made me extremely suspicious about his conduct. Monsieur Rodin ran a boarding school in his house for children of both sexes. He had been granted permission to do this when his wife was still alive, and no one had thought it best to revoke it when he lost her. Monsieur Rodin's pupils were few in number, but carefully chosen. In all, he had only 14 girls and 14 boys. He never took any below the age of 12, and they were always sent away at 16. There was none so pretty as the pupils admitted by Rodin. If one was presented to him with physical defects, or no figure, he was astute enough to reject them on umpteen pretexts that were always based on sophisms which no one could answer. Thus, either he never had a full number of boarders, or else those he did have were always charming. These children did not eat at his place, but came to the house twice a day, from 7 to 11 in the morning, and from 4 till 8 in the evening. If I had not seen all of this little troop before, it was because I had arrived at this man's during the holidays when the schoolchildren were not around, reappearing only as I began to recover. Rodin ran the school himself, his governess taking charge of the girls' class until he took this over as soon as he had finished teaching the boys. He taught these young pupils to write, as well as arithmetic, a little history, drawing, and music, and in all of these lessons he was the only master. I first expressed my astonishment to Rosalie that her father could exercise the function of surgeon, and at the same time that of a schoolmaster. I said to her that it seemed odd to me that, being able to live comfortably without pursuing either of these professions, he should take the trouble to attend to them himself. Rosalie, with whom I got along very well, began to laugh at my observation. The way in which she reacted to what I was saying only served to make me more curious, and I entreated her to open up to me completely. "Listen," this charming girl said to me, with all the candor of her age and all the naivety of her amiable character. "Listen, Thérèse, I shall tell you everything, because I can see that you are an honest girl, incapable of betraying the secret that I am about to confide in you. Assuredly, dear friend, my father can do without all this, so if he pursues either of the professions that you have seen him exercise, he has two motives for doing so, which I shall now explain to you. He practices surgery for the love of it, for the mere pleasure of making new discoveries in his art. He has made so many of them, he has published such well-received studies based on his experiments, that he is generally accepted as being the most brilliant man in France today. He worked in Paris for 20 years, and he retired to the countryside for his enjoyment. The official surgeon in Saint-Marcel is a man named Rambaud, whom he has taken under his wing and whom he involves in his experiments. Do you want to know what makes him run a boarding school now, Thérèse? Libertinism. My child, nothing but libertinism. A passion carried to the extreme in him. My father finds in his pupils of both sexes objects whose dependence on him makes them submissive to his leanings, and he takes advantage of this. But just a moment. Follow me, Rosalie said to me. Today is actually Friday, one of the 3 days in the week when he corrects those who have made errors, and it is in this type of correction that my father takes a personal pleasure. Follow me, I tell you, and you'll see how he goes about it. We can watch from a closet in my bedchamber, which is next door to the room where he conducts his investigations. I'll take you there, but no noise. And above all, take care never to speak a word regarding what I have told you, or what you are about to see. It was too important to me to find out about the morals of this new person who was offering me a refuge, to neglect anything that might reveal them to me. I followed Rosalie, who sat me next to the dividing wall, which was sufficiently badly assembled that the gaps in its planks gave enough light to see all that took place in the adjoining room. We had scarcely assumed our post when Rodin entered, bringing with him a 14-year-old girl, fair of complexion, and as pretty as a picture. The poor creature, her eyes full of tears, unfortunately all too aware of what awaited her, moaned as she followed her harsh teacher and threw herself at his feet begging for mercy. But it was the very severity of the inflexible Rodin that kindled the first sparks of his pleasure, already evident in the ferocity of the looks he gave her.
"Oh, no, no," he cried. "No, no, this has happened with you too many times, Julie. I regret all my kindnesses to you because they have just led you to commit new faults. But could the gravity of this one allow me to use clemency, even assuming that I wanted to? A note passed to a boy as you came to class?"
"Monsieur, I protest that I did not."
"Oh, I saw you, I saw you."
"Don't believe a word of it," Rosalie said to me. "These are faults he invents to give him the excuses he needs. This little creature is an angel. It's because she resists that he treats her so harshly." Meanwhile, Rodin, who has become quite worked up, seizes the girl's hands and ties them above her head to the ring of a pillar situated in the middle of the punishment room. Julie has no more defences, except, that is, for her lovely face languidly turned towards her torturer, her beautiful hair falling around her shoulders, and the tears that are streaming down the prettiest, sweetest, most captivating of features. Rodin becomes excited contemplating this tableau, and covers Julie's imploring eyes with a blindfold so that she can't see anything anymore. Rodin, now more at ease, removes the veils of her modesty, lifting the shirt tucked under her corset to the middle of her back. What white skin! What loveliness! Rose petals scattered on lilies by the hands of the Graces themselves. Who could be so unfeeling as to subject such fresh, such piquant charms to torture? What monster could take pleasure from pain and tears? Rodin contemplates this scene. His wild eyes devour and his hands dare to profane the flowers that his cruelty is about to wither. They are just in front of us, so that no gesture escapes our attention. One moment the libertine begins to reveal all of these sweet features that enchant him, and the next, he hides them again. He offers them to us in every conceivable form, but it is the sweet ones that he is most fond of. Although the true temple of love is within his reach, Rodin stays faithful to his idol and does not even glance in that direction, and even fears its appearance. If her position exposes it, he covers it. The slightest deviation would disturb his devotion. He wants nothing to distract him from it. Finally, his fury knows no bounds. He expresses it first with invective. Then he bombards the poor, unfortunate little thing with threats and improper suggestions, and she trembles beneath the blows which she sees are about to tear her apart. Rodin, no longer in control of himself, grabs hold of a handful of birch rods from a basin of vinegar where they have acquired more flexibility and bite.
"Come," he says, approaching his victim. "Prepare yourself to suffer."
And vigorously striking these bundles directly onto all those parts of her body presented to him, the cruel man first delivers 25 blows, which soon transform the tender rosiness of her fresh young skin into bright vermilion. Julie was screaming. Her screams pierced my very soul, while tears ran from beneath her blindfold, dropping like pearls onto her lovely cheeks, making Rodin even more furious. He runs his hands over the bruises on her body, touching and squeezing them as if about to launch fresh assaults. These do indeed quickly follow his first attacks. Beginning once more, Rodin's blows are all preceded by some invective, threat or reproach. Blood is drawn, and Rodin is in ecstasy, delighting in the contemplation of the visible proofs of his ferocity. He can contain himself no longer, on fire in the most indecent manner. He has no qualms about displaying this indecency. Julie cannot bear to look. In an instant, he is poised to enter her hole, and would like to enter victorious but dares not. Recommencing new tyrannies, Rodin whips her repeatedly with all his might, and these lashes finally succeed in opening up that refuge of grace and sensual delight. He is beside himself, so drunk with lust that he is no longer in possession of his senses, shouting, swearing, blaspheming. Nothing is safe from his barbarous blows. Everything he sees is treated with the same severity. Nevertheless, the villain stops, realizing the impossibility of taking things further without risking losing the strength that he will need for fresh assaults.
"Get dressed," he says to Julie, untying her and adjusting his dress. "And if anything of the kind happens with you again, remember that you won't get away with it so easily."
Once Julie has returned to her class, Rodin goes into the boys and comes back straight away with a young schoolboy of 15, as fair as a summer's day. Rodin scolds him, but probably because he feels more comfortable with him, cajoles and embraces him as he tells him off.
"You deserve to be punished," he says to him, "and so you shall be."
With these words, he exceeds all bounds of decency with this child. Nothing escapes his attention. Nothing is left out. The veils are lifted. Things begin to stir. Rodin threatens him, caresses him, kisses him, curses him, while his impious fingers seek to awaken sensations of voluptuousness in this young boy and demand the same in return.
"Well, lovely though it is,"
the satyr says to him, as he contemplates his success in this regard,
"you are now in a state that I forbade you to enter. I'll wager that with only 2 strokes more, it would shoot all over me."
Confident of the excitement he is causing, the libertine steps forward to accept the boy's homage, and his mouth is the temple that will receive this sweet incense. His hands cause the jets to spurt. He guides them into his mouth and drinks them greedily, while he himself is on the point of exploding, but he is determined to reach his goal.
"Oh, I shall punish you for this blunder," he says, rising to his feet.
He takes the young man's hands and, gripping them, has unrestricted access to the altar at which he desires to sacrifice his fury. He pulls it open, covers it with kisses, and pushes his tongue deep inside. Rodin, drunk with love and ferocity, fills the air with expressions of both.
"Oh, you little rogue!" he cries. "I'm going to pay you back for the effect you're having on me!"
Rodin picks up the birch rods and whips him. Doubtless because he is more excited than with the young Vestal Virgin, his blows become much harder and much more numerous. The child weeps, and Rodin is in ecstasy, but he is tempted by new pleasures. He unties the child and quickly proceeds to make new sacrifices. A little girl of 13 follows the boy, and she is succeeded by another schoolboy, followed by a young girl. Rodin whips 9 children, 5 boys and 4 girls. The last one is a young boy of 14 with delicious features. Rodin attempts to enjoy him, but the schoolboy resists. Mad with lust, he whips him, and losing control, the villain spurts the frothy jets of his passion all over the molested parts of his young pupil, drenching him from top to toe. Furious that he did not have sufficient strength to contain himself, at least until the end, our disciplinarian unties the child with annoyance and sends him back to class, assuring him that he'll make up for it. This is what I heard. These are the events I witnessed.
"Oh, heaven,"
I said to Rosalie when these dreadful scenes were over.
"How can one indulge in such excesses? How can one take pleasure in the infliction of pain?"
"Oh, you don't know it all," replied Rosalie. "Listen," she said to me as we returned to her bedchamber. "What you have seen has proved to you that when my father finds little resistance in these young pupils, he takes his horrific actions much further, abusing girls in the same way as he does boys." As Rosalie explained to me, these crimes were just like those which I had feared I would myself suffer at the hands of the leader of the gang of thieves following my escape from the conciergerie, crimes that the merchant from Lyon actually did inflict upon me.
"By this means," continued this young person, "the girls are not dishonored. There are no pregnancies to fear, and nothing to stop them from finding husbands. There isn't a single year when he does not corrupt nearly all the boys like this, and at least half of the other children. Of the 14 girls that you have seen, 8 are already sullied in this way, and he has enjoyed 9 boys. The 2 women who serve him are subjected to the same horrors."
"Oh, Thérèse," added Rosalie, throwing her arms around me.
"Oh, dear girl, me too. He seduced me when I was an innocent young thing. By the time I was 11 years old, I had already become his victim. alas, this took place before I could defend myself from him. But, mademoiselle, I interrupted her apprehensively, what about religion? This recourse at least remained open to you. Could you not consult a confessor and tell him everything? Oh, don't you realize that as he perverts us, he stifles in us all the seeds of religion, and that he forbids us to practice all of its rites? And in any case, how could I? He has scarcely educated me. The little he has told me about these things was from fear that my ignorance might betray his impiety. But I have never been to confession. I have never made my first communion. He knows so well how to ridicule all of these things, to remove all trace of them from us, that those he has suborned are cut off from their duties for good, or else, if they are forced to carry them out because of their family, they do so in a lukewarm fashion or with such complete indifference that he has nothing to fear from any indiscretion on their part. But let yourself be convinced, Therese, by your own eyes, she continued, quickly pushing me into the closet from which we had just emerged. Come, this chamber in which he punishes his pupils is the same one where he enjoys us. The class is over now. The time has come when, excited by the preliminaries, he will come and make up for the constraints that his prudence sometimes imposes on him. Stand where you were before, dear girl, and your eyes will discover everything. Despite my reluctance to watch these new horrors, it was nevertheless better for me to go back into this closet than to be overheard talking to Rosalie during classes. Rodin would undoubtedly have become suspicious. I therefore took up position. I had scarcely done so when Rodin came into his daughter's room and led her into the chamber where he had just been. The two serving girls of the household soon joined them, and then, having no more constraints, the lewd Rodin indulged himself freely and without any modesty in all the abnormal acts of his debauchery. The two peasant girls, completely naked, are severely whipped. While he directs blows against one of these, the other whips him in turn, and meanwhile he applies the filthiest, the most frenetic, the most disgusting caresses to the same altar in Rosalie who, raised up on an armchair, sticks it up in the air for him. It is finally the turn of this unfortunate girl. Rodin ties her to the post as he did his schoolgirls, and whilst his serving maids took it in turn to scourge him, and sometimes both together, he whipped his daughter, striking her from the middle of the back right down to the bottom of her thighs, ecstatic with pleasure. He is agitated in the extreme, screaming and blaspheming as he delivers his blows. He immediately presses his lips to every spot where his rods leave their mark. The inside of the victim's altar and her mouth, everywhere except the front, is sucked hard by his mouth. Soon, without even changing position but just making it more accessible, Rodin penetrates the tight refuge of pleasure. Meanwhile, the same throne is offered by his governess for him to embrace, and the other girl whips him as hard as she can. Rodin is in ecstasy, ripping and cleaving flesh, 1,000 kisses, each hotter than the previous one, expressing his desire for what is being presented to his lewdness. The bomb explodes, and, drunk with passion, the libertine dares to taste the sweetest pleasures that incest and infamy have to offer. Rodin went off to eat. After such exploits, he needed to restore his strength. That evening, there were classes and punishment, and so I could have observed more scenes if I had wished, but I had seen enough to convince myself and to decide how to respond to this villain's offers. The time for me to give him my answer was approaching. 2 days after these events, he came to my room himself to ask me what I had decided. I was in bed at the time. On the pretext of checking whether there remained any traces of my wounds, so that I could not object, he insisted on examining me naked, and as he had been doing this twice a day for a month, without my noticing anything in him so far that might offend against my modesty, I did not feel able to resist. But Rodin had other plans on this occasion. When he had the object of his devotion within his grasp, he put one of his legs around my back, gripping me so hard that I was, so to speak, defenseless.
"Therese,"
he then said to me, his wandering hands leaving me in no doubt as to his intentions,
"you are now completely recovered, my dear. So now you can show me the gratitude with which I know your heart is full. This is easily done. All I want is this."
The rogue continued, holding me still with all the strength he could summon.
"Yes, this is the only reward I want. This is all I ask from women. but this is one of the loveliest I have ever seen in my entire life.
He continued.
How round it is, how firm. What exquisite skin. Oh, I just have to enjoy it.
So saying, Rodin, who was probably already prepared to carry out his mission, was obliged to let go of me for a moment in order to make it possible, and I took advantage of the time this gave me to free myself from his grip.
Monsieur, I said to him, please believe, I beg of you, that nothing in this whole world could persuade me to submit to the horrors that you seem to desire. I owe you a debt of gratitude, I agree, but I will not acquit it at the cost of a crime. I am doubtless poor and miserable. Nevertheless, here is the little money I possess.
I continued, offering him my poor purse.
Take what you consider appropriate and permit me to leave this house, I beg you, just as soon as I am able.
Confounded by a degree of resistance which he did not expect from a girl devoid of resources, and whom, according to that injustice usual among men, he supposed to be dishonest for the simple reason that she was in a state of misery, Rodin looked at me closely.
Thérèse, he went on after a moment, you're in no position to play the virgin with me. It seems to me that I had the right to a few kindnesses on your part. Never mind. Keep your money, but do not leave me. It suits me very well to have a good girl in the house. I'm surrounded by girls who are far from being so. Since you appear to be so virtuous, I hope that you will therefore be like that in every respect. This is in my interests. My daughter likes you. She has just begged me again to persuade you not to leave us. So, I invite you to stay with us.
Monsieur, I replied, I would not be happy here. The two women who serve you aspire to all the feelings you are able to have for them. They would be jealous of me, and sooner or later I would be forced to leave you.
You need have no fear of that, replied Rodin. You mustn't be afraid of any of the consequences of jealousy from those women. I know how to keep them in their place and to protect yours, and you alone will enjoy my confidence at no risk to yourself. But it is right for you to know that to continue to be worthy of it, the chief quality I demand of you, Thérèse, is absolute discretion. Many things happen here, many of which will offend against your virtuous principles, but you must see all and hear all, my child, and never say a word. Oh, stay with me, Thérèse, stay here, my child. I shall be delighted to keep you. In the midst of so many vices, to which I am drawn by a fiery temperament, an unbridled spirit, and a very spoilt nature, I will at least have the consolation of having a virtuous person near at hand. I will be able to take refuge in her bosom, as at the feet of a god when I am sated with my debauchery.
Oh, heaven, I thought at that moment. So virtue is necessary. It is indeed indispensable to man, since even the vicious criminal is himself obliged to seek reassurance in it, and to take shelter in its arms.
I then recalled how Rosalie had urged me not to leave her, and believing that I recognized some good principles in Rodin, I firmly accepted a position with him.
Thérèse, Rodin said to me a few days later, I'm going to put you with my daughter. That way, you won't have anything to do with my two other women, and I shall give you 300 livres in wages.
Such a position was a real stroke of luck for one in my circumstances. Burning with the desire to bring Rosalie back into the ways of righteousness, and maybe even her father himself, if I managed to gain some influence over him, I had no regrets about what I had just done. Having had me dressed appropriately, Rodin lost no time in taking me to his daughter, announcing to her that he was giving me to her. Rosalie greeted me with unparalleled cries of joy, and I was quickly settled in. A week had not passed when I began to work hard to convert the two of them, but Rodin's obstinacy thwarted all of my efforts.
Do not think, he would reply to my wise counsels, that the homage I have paid to virtue in you is proof either that I esteem virtue or that I would wish to prefer it to vice. You would be quite wrong to imagine this, Thérèse. Anyone who, based on what I have done for you,
deduced from my actions either the importance or the necessity of virtue would be sorely mistaken, and I should be very upset if you believed that such were my thoughts. The hovel that offers me shelter during the hunt when the fierce rays of the sun are shining directly onto me is certainly not an edifice of any utility, its necessity being purely circumstantial. I am exposed to some danger. I find something that protects me from it and make use of it. But is this something any less useless? Can it be any less despicable? In a totally depraved society, virtue would be pointless. Since ours is not of that nature, we must certainly either play the game or make use of it in order to have less to fear from those who follow its path. If no one did so, it would become useless. Therefore, I am not wrong when I maintain that whether virtue is necessary is just a matter of opinion or circumstance. Virtue is not a world of priceless worth. It is just a way of behaving that varies according to climate and consequently has nothing real about it, and that alone reveals its futility. Only those things that are constant are truly good. That which perpetually changes could not aspire to the character of goodness, which is why the immutable was ranked among the perfections of the eternal. But virtue is totally devoid of this character. There are no two races on the surface of the globe that are virtuous in the same way. Therefore, there is nothing real, nothing intrinsically good about virtue, and it in no way deserves our adoration. You must use it as a prop, and diplomatically adopt the style of the country where you live so that those who practice it out of taste or who are obliged to respect it because of their situation leave you in peace and in order that the virtue that is respected where you are protects you through the weight of convention against attacks from those who profess vice. But once again, all of this is a matter of circumstance, none of it attributing any real merit to virtue. Moreover, certain virtues are impossible for some men to follow. Now, how can you persuade me that a virtue which combats or is contrary to the passions can be found in nature? And if it is not in nature, how can it be good? The men in question will assuredly prefer the vices that are opposed to these virtues, since they offer them the only way of living that is best suited to their physique or their organs. According to this hypothesis, therefore, there will be vices that are very useful. Now, how can virtue be useful if you demonstrate to me that its opposite can be so? The response to that is that virtue is useful to others, and in that sense it is good. For, if it is accepted that one should do only what is good for others, they will do only good to me in my turn. Such reasoning is nothing but sophistry. For the little good I receive from others, based on the fact that they practice virtue and that I am obliged to practice it in turn, I make a million sacrifices that in no way compensate me. Receiving less than I give, I am therefore making a bad bargain, experiencing much more harm from the privations I endure in order to be virtuous than I receive good from those who do it. Since this arrangement is not equal, I should therefore not submit to it. If I am virtuous, it is certain that the amount of good I do to others will not make up for the trouble I endure in forcing myself to behave virtuously, and would it therefore not be better for me to renounce the idea of creating a happiness for them that must necessarily cost me as much suffering? There just remain the wrongs I, as a wicked man, can do to others, and the wrongs they will do to me in turn if everyone is like me. Given a complete circularity of vice, I am definitely running risks, I admit. However, the trouble caused me by the risks I take is compensated for by the pleasure of causing risks to others. Thus is balance maintained, and everyone is more or less equally happy, which is not, and could never be, the case in a society where some are good and others bad, because this mixture gives rise to perpetual traps that do not exist in the other scenario. In a mixed society there are diverse interests, and such diversity is the source of an infinite number of misfortunes.
while in the other arrangement all interests are equal, each individual member being endowed with the same tastes, the same leanings, all heading towards the same goal, and everyone is happy. But, idiots will tell you, evil does not make you happy. No, it does not, when people agree to worship good. But, if you see no value in what you call good, if you debase it, you will then revere only what you were stupid enough to call evil, and all men will have the pleasure of committing it, not because it will be permitted. That would sometimes be a reason for its attraction to lessen, but they will no longer be punished for it by laws which, by virtue of the fear they inspire, diminish the pleasure that nature has given crime. Let's imagine a society where it is accepted that incest, to take this offence as an example among many, that incest, I say, is a crime. Those who indulge in it will be unhappy because the general opinion, laws, religion, everything will conspire to spoil their pleasure. Those who want to commit this wrong, and who dare not do so, will be equally miserable because of these restraints. Thus, the law that proscribes incest will have done nothing but make people unhappy, where, in a neighbouring society, incest is not a crime. Those who do not wish to engage in it will not be miserable, and those who do will be happy. Thus, the society that has permitted this act will serve men better than that which has made the same act into a crime. The same is true of all those other acts stupidly considered criminal. If you regard them as such, you make lots of people unhappy. If you allow them, no one complains, since he who likes such acts quietly indulges in them, and he who doesn't care about them either manifests a kind of indifference towards them that is in no way painful, or compensates for the harm he might have been done by a host of other injuries, which he in turn inflicts on those against whom he had a grievance. Thus, everybody in a crime-ridden society is either very happy, or is in a state of unconcern that is not harmful. Consequently, there is nothing good, nothing respectable, nothing that can make people happy in what we call virtue. Those who practice it, therefore, have no reason to be proud just because the particular type of constitution of our societies obliges us to pay it homage. It is purely a matter of circumstance or convention. But in point of fact, this cult is illusory, and to worship virtue for even a single moment does not make it any more attractive.
Such was the infernal logic of Rodin's miserable passions, but Rosalie, far sweeter, far less corrupted, Rosalie who detested the horrors to which she was forced to submit, was more amenable to my opinions. I earnestly desired to have her make her first communion, yet to do so would have necessitated confiding in a priest, and Rodin did not want such men in his house, detesting them as much as the cult they professed. He would not have tolerated one near his daughter for anything in the world, and it was just as impossible to take this young person to a confessor. Rodin never let Rosalie go out unaccompanied. We therefore had to wait for some opportunity to present itself, and while we waited, I gave the young girl instruction. By giving her a taste for virtue, I also inspired in her a taste for religion, revealing to her the holy doctrines and sublime mysteries, and linking both of these so closely in her young heart that I made them indispensable to her happiness. "Oh, mademoiselle," I said to her one day as she shed tears of compunction, "can man be so blind as to believe that he is not destined for a better life? Is it not enough that he has been endowed with the power and the ability to know his God, for him to be convinced that this favour has been granted to him so that he may fulfil the duties it imposes on him? Now, what can be the basis of the worship of the eternal being if not that virtue which he himself exemplifies? Could the creator of so many marvels have any other laws but good? And can our hearts please him if good is not their very substance? It seems to me that with sensitive souls, the only signs of love we need send the supreme being are those inspired by gratitude. Has he not favoured us in giving us the ability to enjoy the beauties of this universe, and do we not owe him some gratitude for such a boon? But, A stronger reason yet establishes and confirms the universal chain of our duties. Why should we refuse to fulfil those required by his laws, since these are the same ones as those which consolidate our happiness among men? Is it not sweet to feel that we render ourselves worthy of the Supreme Being just by exercising those virtues that must ensure our contentment on earth, and that the means which make us worthy of living among our fellow creatures are the same ones as those that give us the certainty of being reborn before God's throne? Oh, Rosalie, how blind are those who would wish to take this hope away from us. Deceived and seduced by their miserable passions, they prefer denial of the eternal verities to a renunciation that would make them worthy of them. They prefer to say we are deceived, rather than to admit that they are themselves deceived. The idea of the losses that they face would disturb their unworthy pleasures. It seems less frightful to them to annihilate all prospect of paradise than to deprive themselves of that which must gain a place there for them. But when these tyrannical passions grow weak in them, when the veil is rent, when nothing in their corrupt souls can any longer equal that majestic voice of the God that they denied in their delirium, oh, Rosalie, how terrible must be their change of heart, and how dearly the remorse that goes with it must make them pay for that moment of error that blinded them. This is the condition in which man must be judged so that his own conduct be regulated. We should not believe what he says when he is intoxicated or when he is carried away by the fever of passion. Only when he can reason calmly, in possession of all his faculties, may he seek truth and find it. Only then do we seek that holy being of our own volition, the God that we hitherto denied. We implore his help, and he consoles us. We pray to him, and he listens. Oh, why, then, would I deny him? Why would I ignore the God who is so necessary to my happiness? Why would I prefer to say, like the soul who has strayed, there is no God, when the heart of the reasonable man at every moment offers me proofs of the existence of this divine being? Is it therefore better to dream with those who are mad than to reason with the wise? Everything is deducible from this first principle. Once God exists, this God deserves to be worshipped, and the basis of this faith is incontestably virtue. From these first truths, I was easily able to deduce the rest, and Rosalie the Deist had soon become a Christian. But I repeat, how was I to turn theory into practice? Forced to obey her father, the most Rosalie could do was to respond to him with disgust, and with a man like Rodin, could this not become dangerous? He was intractable, impervious to all of my beliefs, but if I could not manage to convince him, at least he could not shake my faith. However, such a schooling and the very real and permanent dangers that it represented made me tremble for Rosalie, to the point that I did not feel at all guilty in encouraging her to flee this perverted house. It seemed to me that wrenching her from the bosom of her incestuous father was a lesser evil than leaving her there exposed to all the risks that she might run. I had already gently broached this subject, and I was possibly not that far from succeeding, when suddenly Rosalie disappeared from the house without its being possible for me to know where she was. When I inquired of Rodin's women, or of Rodin himself, as to her whereabouts, I was assured that she had gone to spend the summer at a relative's house 10 leagues away. When I asked around the neighbourhood, people first expressed astonishment at such a question coming from someone in the household, and then they would give me the same answer as Rodin and his servants. They had seen her, and kissed her goodbye the previous day, the very same day of her departure, and I received everywhere the same response. When I asked Rodin why I had not been told that she had left, and why I had not followed my mistress, he assured me that the only reason had been to avoid a painful scene for both of us, and that I would no doubt soon see my beloved Rosalie again. I had to accept these excuses, but I found it more difficult to be convinced by them. Was it plausible that Rosalie, who loved me so much, could have agreed to leave me without saying a word? And from what I knew of Rodin's character, there was much left unsaid regarding the wretched girl's fate. I therefore resolved to do all I could to find out what had become of her, and every means seemed acceptable to me to achieve this. The very next day, finding myself alone in the house, I carefully search every corner. Thinking I can hear moans coming from a very dark cellar, I draw nearer. A pile of wood appears to block a narrow concealed door. I move closer, pushing all obstacles aside. Fresh noises can be heard. I believe I recognize the voice. I listen, hard. There is no doubt in my mind.
Therese!